Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
And from what Jimmy tells me this morning, we pretty much got an empty phone bank going, so shouldn't have any trouble getting through. You know, the lines tend to get a little jammed up later in the show, so you'd like to get on early, got something you'd like to ask or talk about regarding gardening or nature or all the sorts of things we talk about here on Saturday or Sunday mornings, you know the number, 210-599-5555. I'm going to start out the show the same way I did last week, and that is reminding people, especially those of y'all that live in the country like I do, just a few things that you really need to do to lower the risk of wildfire or you lower the risk that you will lose property if we unfortunately have a wildfire. It's just conditions are so ripe and so dangerous, and boy, it doesn't take many things like the Maui fire, the California fire a few years ago. Most of us remember the Bastrop fire. Those events can certainly happen again, and two of the things that you can do that will really help give you protection that are very simple. Number one, keep your gutters clean. My firemen friends tell me it's amazing how many houses burn because there's a brush fire going somewhere, you've got a few firebrands floating through the air, they land in a gutter full of leaves, ignite those leaves, spreads to the roof, and there goes the house. The second thing is very important, keep the grass mowed as low as possible for some distance out around your home. In fact, it'd be better if you had no grass at all up within 10 feet or so of your barns and home and things like that, because the height of the flames depends on how high whatever it is burning. And if your grass is 2 inches tall, your flames may be up to 6 inches high. If you let those grass and weeds grow up to, you know, 20, 30 inches, something like that, the flames will be over your head. So one of these cool mornings, one of these cool evenings, if your grass around your home, around your buildings, things like that, if it's not mowed down to a reasonable level, it certainly would be a good idea, just a good ounce of protection to be sure that you keep it down low. Garden-wise, golly, I don't know what to tell you about so many things. I'm putting off planting some of the things that I normally plant in August, like broccoli and even cauliflower. I'm going to wait until September. I'm going to give this weather just a little break. They're saying that we're going to have one cooler day this next week, Tuesday. Originally, they were saying Tuesday and Wednesday, and originally they were giving us a good chance of rain, but now that's down to like 40%. But I don't know, sometimes it seems like we get our best rains when they don't really forecast them. So keep your fingers crossed. We really, really do need the rain, but it's just, you know, with the air temperatures up above 100 degrees and the radiant effect of the sun, it's just awful hot to be setting out new little transplants. Now, your tomatoes you really need to get planted, especially your large fruited tomatoes, because if you don't get them in, they won't have time to be setting fruit before the nights start getting too cool again. So get them in, just give them a little protection from the sun. Be sure that you're watering properly and do all the things we normally do when we plant tomatoes. But a little protection from the afternoon sun and the hot, dry wind, both of those things will help a great deal in getting your tomatoes off to a good start. And you sure want to have a good good fall garden. Well, looks like everybody's up and ready to talk now. It looks like it's going to be Betty and Sandy and Homer and Chris. Betty's first in line. Let's get started. Good morning, Betty.
Yay, I won the lottery.
Well, maybe that'll happen later today. You won the phone tag lottery, and unfortunately it's not worth $1 million, but it's good to talk to you. How can I help?
I'm going to put down some decomposed granite, and I don't remember if you said do or do not put weed block down.
Do not put weed block down for any number of reasons. It will keep the granite from setting up hard. It'll always be loose. You'll always slide when you step on it. And It's just no. It just puts your decomposed granite down. If it is on a slope or something like that where you're worried about it washing, and again, the weed block wouldn't help with that anyway, but you can always get some powdered cement, not concrete, but cement, and mix in a wheelbarrow, you'd mix like a shovel full of cement to maybe 10 scoops of granite, and it will harden. It will make a surface that will simply not wash away. I do this on some of my roads and places, just a regular walking path or something like that, though you don't need to do a thing other than just clear out as much weedy material as you can and spread that decayed granite down.
Okay, what it is I have flagstone down now, but it's sunken a little bit and muddy, so I wanted to raise it up with the decomposed granite and then put the flagstone back on top of that.
You can do that. You can actually use ordinary sand if you want to. In some ways, ordinary, just, you know, what you get at a box store, they'll call it play sand or something like that. That will work just as well to raise your flagstone and put them in place. But then if you want to put some decomposed granite around the stone so you don't have those big gaps in between, that would be by far the best material to use because it stays in place better. But as far as raising the stones and anchoring them, I just use just ordinary old concrete sand for that.
Okay, that sounds great. Well, thank you for your advice.
Well, thank you for getting up early and giving me a call this morning. You have a wonderful Sunday, Betty. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Certainly. Bye. Next on the list is Sandy. Good morning, Sandy.
Hi, Bob. I think you already answered my tomato question, but I have some lemon boys that I've been keeping in gallon pots waiting for the forecast to be something less than 100, which it's going to be a long wait, I guess.
Well, Tuesday it's going to be nice. Tuesday, I think the high is supposed to be 92, but Monday and Wednesday, we're back to the usual. So have a Tuesday garden party.
So if I put insulate around them and maybe on top of them to shade them, you think it's pretty safe to maybe put them
absolutely.
Out?
Absolutely.
And,
you know,
go ahead.
Again, I would not worry if you do like I do and put the tomato cage over and just wrap the insulate around the lower couple of feet. That brief period of time when the sun's shining directly down, that's not going to be enough to hurt them. I mean, you could put a little flap of insulate over the top if you want, but I really doubt that it's necessary. But the insulate does double duty. It gives you, it acts as a, you know, as a sunscreen, and it also cuts down on the drying wind. So your lemon boys and all your other tomatoes will love you for doing that.
And if I can find some sweet 100s or, you know, the smaller tomatoes, what's the latest that you would guess that I could put them in the garden as opposed to just putting them in gallon pots for a little while?
Well, it's going to take, and of course it depends on the size of the transplant you start with, but I normally think that it's going to take about 30 days for them to start producing. So, and the cherry tomatoes, like the sweet 100s, don't pay any attention to night temperatures, so they should produce right up until the time they freeze. So you can plant them, well into September, and of course the earlier the better, but they're not like the lemon boys and celebrities and, you know, the big fruited types. The big fruited types don't set fruit if the nights are too hot or too cold, and that's why our timing is a little more critical on them. Cherries don't pay any attention to night temperature, so you plant them when you want. Just know you'll start picking about 30 days after you plant them. So I would get them in the ground as soon as it's convenient. They'll actually be happier in the ground than they will in bigger pots because the soil stays much cooler, and you get them in the ground just gives them a chance to spread out and develop a really good root system. So I think you'll find that they are available at the nurseries. I know we've had pretty good luck. We sell out of them, and then we get more. But right now, I think you'll find most of your nurseries will have sweet 100s, and a lot of them will still have some sun golds, too.
Okay. And I have a couple of, like, three eggplant plants that I've kept alive since the spring garden.
Good for
and,
you.
They're putting on blossoms, but, of course, the blossoms aren't setting anything, probably because of the heat. Any idea when they might actually start doing something?
Well, they need to be pollinated, and they really should be setting some fruit now. Now, the fruit's not going to get very big. It's going to be a third the size of what you would have in the spring. It will get back up to full size when the temperatures, you know, drop by about 20 degrees, which normally happens by September. But in our gardens, we're seeing lots and lots and lots of bumblebees and very few honeybees. And the bumblebees are good pollinators, but I wouldn't hesitate to get a little paintbrush and get out there and just kind of dust around inside the flowers, because there's really no reason, even in the heat, that they shouldn't set at least some fruit.
Okay. Thanks very much, Bob.
And good luck with it. Thank you for the call, Chris.
Really, bye-bye.
Sandy, I really appreciate it. Let's see. Homer and Chris, hang on just a second. I don't want to get behind here. So let me get a quick break done, and then you guys will be up next. I get to talk about Sam Sitterly and Green Grow Organics. And happened again yesterday. Customer came in and, you know, with a phone full of pictures, but the pictures weren't good enough to really tell what kind of problems he was having, you know, in the yard. And I told him, as I tell so many people, if you would like somebody to come out and actually walk your landscape with you and tell you what needs to be done to improve things, to turn things around, well, think about Sam Sitterly and Green Grow Organics. That's what he's been doing for, oh gosh, over 30 years now, helping people with their landscapes and helping them solve problems, helping them have the absolute prettiest landscapes they possibly can. He's got a program where, you know, you can call them as you need them. A lot of people set it up for them to come around on a quarterly basis, sometimes even on a monthly basis, just to walk through. And that's, you know, the doctor wants to see the patient to really tell you what's going on. And Sam and his guys have been doing that for a long time, and everything they do is organic, and that's why I enjoy talking about him. Check out his website, Green Grow, spelled out G-R-O-W, Green Grow Organics. And if it looks, program looks good to you, give him a call, set up a consultation. Be sure you understand any charges up front. But there's just an awful lot of people who owe their beautiful landscapes to Sam and Green Grow Organics. Number is 599-5565, 210-599-5565. Start by checking out the website, though, greengroworganics.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening, and I do have an open line now, so grab it if you like, 210-599-5555. We're going to talk to Homer and Chris, and Homer is up next. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
I hope I have a simple question. I'm down here in Rockport, and I'm getting some free fill. How high can I put the sand around the trees that are there, the old oak trees?
Zero. You don't want to come up at all around the trunk. Now, over the root zone, if you need to bring it up, you can do, you know, 3, 4, 5 inches. But the trunk above and below ground is a totally different structure. Above the ground, the trunk has nothing to waterproof it, in effect. And I've seen oak trees ultimately kill by even a couple of inches of material piled up around the trunk. So if you need to make a little saucer-like crater or something like that, that's fine. If you have an area where you need to do some serious filling, just build like a little silo around it. You just want to have air circulation around the trunk. You don't have to come out 4 feet away or anything like that. You just don't want anything heavy and potentially wet up against the bark.
Okay. That answers that. Thank you, sir.
Well, it's my pleasure. Appreciate the call. Thank you, Homer.
You have a good morning.
You do the same, sir. Pray for rain as well. I know the coast needs it about as bad as we do. That bay's getting pretty high saline content. So, and unfortunately, well, I guess fortunately or unfortunately, the Gulf is quite warm. So tropical storm potential is certainly there. We'll take a lot of rain just under the other things that sometimes come along with those storms. Back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Chris is next in line. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Let me get you off a speakerphone.
I appreciate that. What's going on today?
Okay. Well, you all answered almost every question I had. Everyone, about how are we going to set up the tomatoes, where put the insulate over it. You don't need to cover the top of it and all that. My question is, I just lost it. I'm sorry. I'll call back later. That just totally, y'all answered all my questions already.
Well,
have a good one, everybody.
The insulate is so easy to use because you, in effect, just put the cage around, and I just use clothespins is how I put it on because it goes on easily, goes on quickly, and comes right back off. I try to go maybe 2 feet up the cage because that, you know, that's going to cast a moving shadow as the sun moves overhead. And it's the air temperature is not bad.
And after they're that tall, yeah, after they're tall enough to get, quote, over the insulate, then they're well set.
Then they should be well set. And the thing to remember is that it's not the air temperature that really matters, and tomatoes don't care if it's 102 degrees. They really don't mind that. But the sun's energy is what we call radiant heat, which means it heats the surface that it hits. So if it's 102 out there, that sun's shining on the leaves, you might have a leaf temperature of 130 degrees, and that's going to burn. And that's what you're – I like to tell you why, not just what, but why you do it. But when you put a shade cloth of any sort, and I just think the insulate's one of the easiest to use and readily available – and easy to cut if you need to, but you're just wanting to keep the sun from pounding down on the leaves. So don't worry about the fact that the air temperature is 102, 103, 104. The tomatoes really don't mind that, but just initially getting started until it gets built up to where they're used to it, that's what you're doing with your insulate. And remember to spray with your liquid seaweed periodically because it's probably the principal pest that I'm seeing in gardens right now is spider mites, and that liquid seaweed will, you know, harden, toughen those leaves to where spider mites are much less likely to be an issue. So those are the questions you didn't know you needed to ask. And you called
but
me back.
My okra is doing wonderful. I've looked around at all the people around, and almost all of us are like, everything's dead. So we dig tomatoes up and everything. But everyone's okra is like, we love this.
Well, yeah, it's a plant. The original varieties originated in some of the very hot parts of Africa. So it is a plant that doesn't mind the heat, doesn't mind the humidity. And I tell you, anybody who doesn't like okra has never had good Cajun cooking. And when I was young, I thought that slime was going to be really terrible. And as I've gotten older, it's one of my favorite things. In fact, I'll probably have curried okra along with my lunch today. So you get out and enjoy. Always good to hear from you. And
thank you.
I'll look forward to that question when you think of it. Let's see here. Yeah, let's go ahead and take another call. It's going to be James and Joe and Shirley now. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Bob. How are you doing this morning?
I'm off to a good start. It's when I left home, it was actually 73 degrees, which was pretty comfortable. Of course, it was 82 when I got to San Antonio. But, hey, welcome to Texas in August.
I'm glad I got a hold of you. I got just one question I've been concerned about.
Okay.
I like shrimp plants.
Yeah.
Shrimp plants, the hummingbirds love them.
Absolutely.
And anyway, my shrimp plants are starting to get little bitty black specks on them.
Are they?
I'm told that you just cut that off and it'll induce growth.
Right. Are the specks a part of the leaf or can you brush them off of the leaf?
I believe you could actually brush them off.
It's probably just, no polite way to put it, caterpillar poop or lizard or something like that.
I'll tell you what, Bob, what I'm doing right now, I'm walking out here,
uh-huh.
And I am actually, they don't brush off. They're just on the right on the ends.
Okay.
Of the leaves.
Yeah, it can be a tiny little harmless fungus. There are a lot of things that can cause that. The heat can cause it. If it's not too unsightly, just leave it alone, fertilize. As the temperatures abate just a little bit, you'll go back to having whorls of flowers. If you want to cut them back, just be sure you don't cut them back by more than about half. You want to leave plenty of green foliage on there. But a lot of folks are saying right now, hey, it's too hot to get nice blooms. I might as well go ahead and cut them back and let them thicken up and come back out again. And there's nothing wrong at all with that. I would water and then apply some fertilizer. Might even put a little Garrett juice, a little bit of Super Thrive on there. But if you think they would look better with a haircut. Just don't make it a burr cut. You don't want to cut them all the way down. But you can take off a third, take off maybe half of the top, and that's going to get them coming back a lot fuller and thicker. But
They're getting morning sun, and some afternoon hot sun too. Mm-hmm. Could that be burning the leaves a little bit?
It's probably not actually sunburning. If it were sunburn, it wouldn't be little spots. It would be big spots. But it heats the leaf temperature up to where you can get small areas that either have an opportunistic fungus called Cercospora, or if you know they've gotten water on them in the middle of the day, little drops of water can act as magnifying glasses, little prisms that will burn the tissue underneath. But I don't believe in any event that it's a serious disease. It doesn't sound like a serious insect problem. So if you'd like to cut them back, go ahead. If you'd like to ignore them, go right ahead. This isn't anything to worry about. And I'm with you. Shrimp plants are wonderful. They take the winters. They take the summers. And like you see, the hummingbirds love them.
Yeah, the perennials, they come back, and, you know, it's just great.
Yeah. There are some other closely related plants which are also beautiful. If you like shrimp plants, you might like a plant they call Mexican honeysuckle. It's not really a honeysuckle. It's a justicia, which is the same genus as shrimp plants. But if you want another gorgeous, super hardy thing, check out Mexican honeysuckle sometime. And people confuse an annual tropical they call lollipop plant or pachystache, which has a bright yellow flower. There is also a yellow shrimp, which is sort of a greenish yellow. I don't think it's nearly as pretty as the sort of coral-colored one, but if that's a plant you like, there's some closely related things that you could also grow that, just like the shrimp plant, they don't mind the heat. If they freeze down,
the honeysuckle, is it a perennial?
Yes, absolutely. It's like shrimp. It only freezes in a really cold winter, and then it comes right back out, and it has a beautiful orange-red flower on it. It's actually showier than the shrimp plant is, but like I say, they're first cousins and just something else you might enjoy growing.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Always a pleasure. You have a great Sunday, and I know we'll talk again. Let's see. Yeah, the clock says now I better take a break. Joe, you will be up next, and then it'll be Shirley. Looks like I get to talk about Rhonda's Nature's Way, and I want you to make a note of the date. Next Tuesday, I believe that's the 22nd of August, is a very special day because it's Rhonda's birthday. That alone makes it a very special day, and I hope everybody will take time to wish her a happy birthday. And the fun thing is that they sort of have a birthday party all day long for you to enjoy as well. They're going to have some frozen fruit juice pops, I guess is the best way to describe them. They're going to have some wonderful cold drinks. She may be even whipping up some of that Ultima that I like so well, you know, along with some goodies to eat. They're just going to be all sorts of fun things, and that's going to go on all day Tuesday at Rhonda's Nature's Way. As she says, drinks and teas, treats and frozen fruit pops, it just doesn't get much better than that on a hot day. If you've not been to Rhonda's, this will be a great opportunity for you to look around and see all the wonderful things she carries, things that will help you stay on your diet plan that really tastes good and sweet without the calories, things that give you the nutrition you need, things like the Ultima that I love that give you the electrolytes you need to work out in the heat, and yet don't bring in a lot of sugar like those sports drinks do. And then, of course, the very best supplements to support your immune system, things that will help alleviate problems like digestive issues or sleep issues. Rhonda's there to help you live better naturally, has been there for over 40 years. Wonderful people at Rhonda's Nature's Way, and let's all get together on Tuesday and wish Rhonda a very, very happy birthday. Shop's located, if you've not been there, it's located in the shopping center at the corner of I-10 and Callahan, kind of across the parking lot from Sprouts. If you enjoy good health, you'll enjoy Rhonda's Nature's Way.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. It really is a pretty morning out there. It's just going to warm up. And as I'm sure you've discovered, the air temperature is just not that bad. But boy, when that sun comes out, hope you're wearing a wide-brimmed hat. And you probably do like I do. You get those lightweight shirts, you know, that are good to keep the sun off of you without really making you hot. And I tell you what, your dermatologist will certainly be proud of you. if you do just that. Let's get back to the phone lines. Joe and Shirley are my next two callers, and Joe is up first. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
A couple questions.
All right.
I got a couple lemon trees that I have growing in containers.
Uh-huh.
And there seems to be an ant problem with them. There's a little black ants that are, I don't know if they're going to do any harm or what I can do to get rid of them.
Are they in the soil or are they just on the plants themselves?
They're in the soil.
Okay. Those are probably fire ants, and they will do damage. It's not that they eat so much on the roots, although they do some of that, but they kind of waterproof some of the soil around the roots, so they are something that you would really like to get rid of. Probably the best thing to do is to get this insecticide called spinosad or spinosad, some people say. It's non-toxic to people and pets. Mix up however much water it would take to give those lemons a thorough watering, and you know, just put it, use at the rate of about 2 tablespoons per gallon of water. Use that to water your trees. It'll kill the ants without harming the trees, and certainly doesn't affect the fruit in any way. So, yeah, it's a lot of people are having problems with the fire ants in containers. I don't know what it is. Seems like the hotter and drier the weather gets, the ants just spread into the pots as well as in the ground. So that's an easy problem to solve, but I most definitely would do it. I like spinosad because it's harmless to, you know, other animals and yet harmless to the plants. You can also use orange oil, but you have to be careful to make your orange oil very dilute, no more than maybe half a teaspoon to a teaspoon per gallon, because if you get it too strong, it will burn the roots. But if you already have some orange oil, just a very dilute solution of that mixed up and poured through the pots will also kill the ants almost instantly.
Well, how do you spell this first one you were talking about?
S is in Sam, P is in Paul, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D.
S-A-D?
S-A-D is in dog.
Alrighty, I'll try to find some of that.
Let me tell you one more thing. If you are getting just straight spinosad, it may be under a weird name, which is Captain Jack's Dead Bug, but it will say it's with spinosad, and it works real well. For many other insect problems, I like using spinosad soap, which is also available under several names, but it's a combination of insecticidal soap plus spinosad. But for ant killing, all you need is a straight spinosad soap. But probably the brand you're going to look for is Captain Jack's Dead Bug.
Okay. And my other question. I tried growing some squash in the spring.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed like the plant did real good. It had nice buds on it, but it seemed like the part that does the zucchini, it never budded. The buds never opened up. And I tried doing it again this fall. I'm trying to do it, but it seems like they're doing the same thing. The one bud will come out, but not the one with the fruit on it. Or the squash.
Okay. Yeah, with the heat, you get a lot of male flowers and fewer female flowers. Be sure that when you water, you're soaking things very, very deeply. And when you do get the flowers, I mean, there are just not many bees out there. You may have to hand pollinate, and that means just getting a little paintbrush, dusting around inside the flower that has all the yellow down inside, dust that around onto the other. It's almost certainly just heat-related, and as it cools off, you can usually get a good crop of squash, but it's really not unusual in the heat for the plants to produce far more male flowers than they do female flowers. That should change just as it cools a little bit, but like I say, be prepared. You may have to be the bee that does the pollinating, because there just are not a lot of honeybees out there right now.
Well, there's not a lot now, so yeah, that's what I've been done in the past too, was pollinated myself.
Yeah,
it worked out good, but now the other one was never budding, so I couldn't pollinate.
Well, it's 107 degrees is tough on a lot of plants, and early in the spring, everybody had good squash, but everybody I know is complaining that their squash and cucumbers as well just are not doing much in the heat. And hopefully, well, we know it's going to cool off as we get into shorter days, but I tell you, still looking out 2 weeks, the weather forecast, other than the one day next Tuesday, they're still showing above 100 degrees. The good news is we can grow squash way up into the fall. Typically, we don't get a freeze until after Thanksgiving, and only takes about 30 days, actually, from the time you plant crookneck and even zucchinis. Only takes about 30 days from the time you plant the seed until you have squash. So you may want to hold off a little bit till the heat does break a little bit. But like I say, you can plant the seeds fairly well up into the fall and still harvest good squash. But I don't know what we can do. Well, we can't do a thing about this weather, but that's what's holding the garden back. It's not anything you're doing or failing to do. If you wanted to put up a little bit of shade cloth, I have a section of my garden where I have 30% shade over it in the summer months, but quite frankly, the heat plus being just really busy, I haven't planted a late summer crop of squash. But if you wanted to put up a little shade cloth, that will help because it does reduce the intensity of the sun. You probably get squash sooner, but it's not a lot of fun being out working in the heat to put up shade cloth either.
I grow them in containers, so I kind of have them under a tree so they get some sun, but not a whole lot and not that much heat.
Well, be sure they get strong morning sun. That afternoon sun you'd like to protect them from, but they do need a few hours of sun to get them to bloom well. So may need to move them a little bit closer out to the edge.
Well, that's why I have them. I'm going to get them in the morning when it gets high up over where it's actually under the tree, then it's already had the sun in the morning.
Well, yeah, enjoy the things that are doing well. The peppers are starting to come out well and the tomatoes, but just not a real good year for squash yet. But you know it's going to cool down. And like I say, the nice thing about squash, I know the seed package. I think the seed package on Crookneck, says it takes 42 days to produce or something like that. But I try to keep a good gardening journal. And in the summer months, I find that my Crooknecks start producing in as little as 20 days. So you've got a good deal of time left to still get some good squash before the fall's over.
Okay, I think I'll start some new ones then.
Yeah, absolutely. Seed's cheap, and it will, I promise, sooner or later it's going to cool down. And I'm sure you've probably noticed the nights are cooling down. The past 2 weeks, we probably lost 5 degrees off what the night temperatures were. It's just those afternoons that are still just hard on people and plants both.
Yeah. I know what you mean.
Well, get out and enjoy and keep me posted on how they do.
Okay, thanks for your help.
Always a pleasure, Joe. Thank you very much. All right, let's see here. Yeah, let's go ahead and talk to Shirley. She's been waiting a few minutes. Good morning, Shirley.
Good morning. I walked out into the patio area with my dogs this morning, and some little red berries caught my eye. I had not noticed them before. Some are green, some are turning red. And I looked it up on one of those apps, and it says they are Carolina coral bead.
Well, I've always known them as Carolina snail seed. They are in the genus Smilax, and that is one of the worst weeds in the entire world. It's a vine. Yeah. It's what beautiful. You're seeing is a vine, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's crawling up on a metal thing I have there.
Well, and it is the devil to get rid of. It's got kind of a woody underground runner, and I consider that the worst weed in the garden. I'll take nutsedge, I'll take Johnson crass, I'll take anything over Carolina snail seed, but that stuff is, I mean, I guess you say it has a pretty red berry, but it's going to try to take over your entire landscape, and it is, like I say, it is hard to get rid of. Because you end up having to pull up, and they make a long underground runner. And if it were mine, it's certainly not something I'd be protecting. It's something I'd be trying to pull out as much as I possibly could.
Well, I have my project for in the morning. destroy it. But it was so pretty, and it's, okay. I looked it up, and it said it's poison also.
Well, I would call it mildly toxic. It's not deadly poison like oleander or sagos or something like that, but it's still a good thing to be rid of. And if you run out of stuff to pull, you can come pull some of mine. I've got a good lifetime supply of it as well.
Okay. No, I have enough things to do, but tomorrow, well, Tuesday, I guess. Well, I will be out there pulling it up and cutting it down as far as I can.
You do a good job of it. It's my pleasure, Shirley. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. All right, better get a break in here, and I get to talk to you about Fanex. More good news from Fanex. Well, I guess good news for us, not so good news for them, is they decided they are a bit overstocked, and as they say, they would rather water it or rather sell it than water it. So they've made the decision to extend that sale. They were doing it just last weekend only. It was such a popular thing that they've extended it all the way into September, and it's figs, bananas, bougainvilleas, and tropical hibiscus are all 30% off. The plumerias are 20% off. And all those are wonderful things to be planting this time of year. So if you want to save some money, you know, Fanex would love to help you out with figs, bananas, bougainvilleas, and tropical hibiscus. They also want me to let you know that next Saturday, the 26th, they're going to have a free seminar they're calling Yard Recovery or Lawn Recovery. It's going to be, I believe, at 10:30 over there. You might check their website to be sure. But two fun things going on. While you're over there, do check out. They've got a great selection of crepe myrtles, as they always do in the summer months. Started getting their fall vegetables in. They've got all that quiet lithium-ion battery-powered equipment from Ego. And, of course, the good Traeger pellet grills and accessories. Fanex is more than just a nursery, but they are an excellent nursery. Been around for over, right about 90 years, I believe, now. And with 10 acres of ground, they've got room to have just about everything you can imagine. Lots of organic products, too, both for insect control along with mulches and fertilizers and compost. Just always a good day to go visit Fanex and to take advantage of the big sale they're having right now. Over on Home Green Road, right where they've been for about 90 years, check out their website at Fanex, F-A-N-I-C-K, FanexNursery.com to get the latest updates at Fanex Nursery and Garden Center.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster, News Talk 550, KTSA, and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to gardening. And once again, do have some lines open if you were getting a busy signal there for a while. Know the number, 210-599-5555. Waiting right now is Ron. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning,
Good morning, sir.
I'm the guy who has a ranch out in Real County. I don't know if you remember this, but I was in Shades of Green during the last drought, which was, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
And I don't know if you remember what you said, but I've repeated it probably 100 times. You said, well, you know, we live on the edge of a desert. Mm-hmm. Where our droughts are interrupted by flash floods.
And I bet you're as ready as I am for a flash flood right now.
Well, I you know, I say there's truth in all humor, or some truth in all humor, so I think that's true. Well, here's my question. You have a product that I've seen or heard advertised called the Tree Hugger.
Right.
Irrigation system. And
right.
If I understand the ad, it sounds like they're dripping water right at the base of the tree. That's not where you water a tree, is it?
Well, it's actually a sprayer. You want to water. That's one thing we have learned in the past probably 5 years about watering, that we find that trees take up the majority of their water within 10 feet of the trunk. It's not out by the drip line. Drip line is where trees are taking up a lot of nutrients. But you're right. I don't like watering right at the base of the tree. But that zone for maybe 5 feet out away from the trunk until you get 10 feet out away from the trunk, that's the ideal spot to be, you know, to be applying the water. Now, and, you know, a lot of people like the tree huggers real well. They kind of spray a bit of water up, and I don't like water in the air because so much of it evaporates. But not a bad product, but again, it's not something that I use. I'll just put it that way. I'm more of a lay the hose on the ground guy and turn it on and then just move it around a bit. But they are right in that you don't need to go all the way out to the drip line to effectively water your trees.
Okay. Well, that's what I thought. I do what you do. And then, I spray the trunk, like you said.
Oh, yeah.
All the foliage as well. I've got a beautiful, a Monterey oak? I think it is.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Just, I wish I had discovered that tree a long time ago.
It is an outstanding tree, and I love it because, you know, it just being in the white oak group, oak wilt is generally not a problem with it. It's fast growing, and I tell you, it's an amazingly resilient tree. My partner had one, this probably been 15 years ago, struck by lightning out about 30 feet away from her house. And lightning did some things to mess up some things in the house, and it just burned a big gouge down the side of that tree. And when it first happened, I wondered, if the tree was even going to survive. Today, that thing's got a trunk that's probably 5 inches thick, and you cannot see a sign of the trauma on that tree. They're just a good tree. You've got to water them to, keep them, get them started. They're pretty darn tough. Nothing's quite as tough as the old live oaks, but again, to get something that's resistant to oak wilt, that just doesn't have insect problems and gives good shade. And cold winters, they're going to drop all their leaves. Mild winters are going to hold some of that foliage. But it's become probably one of my top five trees, maybe even one of my top three trees to recommend to people. Some of them got a bit of cold damage when we got down, in the single digits. But everyone that I've looked at has come back out, and you see no sign of that cold at all. So heaven forbid if we, ever drop below zero, but we'll have more to worry about than just a few trees if that happens.
Well, that's true. Yeah, this tree survived the 2021 freeze quite well. I mean, you couldn't ever tell that it had that kind of freeze. I thought coming from Mexico, it probably couldn't tolerate that kind of temperature, but it did.
Yep.
Well, listen, thank you, Bob. I enjoy your show. I appreciate all your good information.
Well, it's always a pleasure. And, man, I hope you made plenty of hay, because that hay has sure gotten expensive. And as a rancher, those old cows get pretty hungry when it gets pretty dry. So you get out.
Yeah.
It's, but we've been through this before. And we know it's going to change, but my good meteorologist that I talk to, and he's not one of these clowns that tries to forecast weather, but he's a man who knows why weather happens. And he says that, when the water temperature does certain things in the Western Pacific, it shifts us into what we call the El Nino pattern. He says we're in it now. He said, but the water was just so hot that those currents and things are behaving differently than we've ever seen before. He said, if we can break that down a little bit, it usually, as the days get shorter, it's going to always cool down some, that we have the potential to go back into milder weather and good rains. And I sure hope he's right, and I sure hope it happens in the near future. But in the meantime, it's always good to hear your voice. Hope it's not 5 years before we get to talk again.
Okay. Thank you, Bob.
You're sure welcome. Thank you, Ron. All right. About 45 seconds until our news break here, and are some open lines. Grab one of them if you like. I don't want to have to do a monologue, and you don't want to hear a monologue from me, but the number 210-599-5555. There are still lots of good things to plant. Had a couple in here a couple of days ago. Having a party next week and saying, what can I do to make the yard look nice? There's still great things like periwinkles out there. A lot of pretty good pentas showing up. There's still some good angelonia. And perennials like shrimp plant we were talking about in the shade, and plumbago. And anyway, there's just lots to do in the yard. Just do it in the morning rather than in the hot afternoon. We'll be right back here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, let's get back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Looks like Scott and Jean and Omar. Scott's first in line. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
So I cleaned up the yard. I've got a back of my truck is full of rocks about the size of your fist.
Right.
Where in the world can I dispose of these?
Generally, there you'll see a construction site around somewhere that says clean fill wanted, and that is probably your best bet. Many builders, developers, they welcome fill material like that, and as long as there's no construction debris or anything mixed in with it, they're happy to have that. That's
a great idea.
Yeah, it that's probably the best I can tell you. I've got so many rocks, and I've got places, you know, I put them where I want to retard erosion and things like that. And thank God my gator's got a dump bed on the back of it, or I'd have a broken back by now. But in almost all parts of town, you've got some construction going on, and I can't tell you how many times I pass a sign that says clean fill wanted. So that's where I would start looking.
Perfect. Okay, thank you very much.
That all you need?
Yes, sir.
Well, that was a good one. Let me know if I can help you further, Scott. Happy to do so.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. And goodbye. Gene is next in line. Good morning, Gene.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm off to a good start. The sun's shining. It's a beautiful morning. It's just going to get hot again. So, like my old buddy Alton Grimm used to say, every day we're one day closer to the next good rain. And far be it for me to wish the time would go by any faster, but I'm ready to get out of August and on into a little bit more, hopefully, typical fall weather.
Oh, so are we. Bob, I have a question. I've got a large arch oak tree. It's 30 years old. I planted it. And it's got a limb that started laying on the ground. And that limb, it's a really large one. It's at least 10 inches in diameter.
Oh, wow.
So I've heard this is the time to cut, to prune, and then I've heard because of this weather, don't do anything now. Could you tell me?
Well, the only reason that people say that it's a good time to prune is that they are under the misguided impression that you don't have to prune or you don't have to paint pruning wounds in the hot summer months because you're less likely to get oak wilt. And that is true, but I'm not going to risk getting oak wilt. I'm going to paint, you know, whenever I prune. And that's the principal reason they're saying the summertime is a good time to prune. I don't necessarily agree. I talk to a lot of arborists who basically prune 365 days out of the year. I will tell you that the reason that the tree does that is that it's trying to shade the root system. The soil's going to be much cooler. If you got a soil probe thermometer and went out, the temperature of that soil in the shade may be as much as 50 or 60 degrees cooler than it would be if the sun was beating down on that ground. So I wouldn't necessarily take that whole limb off. I would trim what I needed to do to be able to use the yard as I want to do it. But that's perfectly normal for a big live oak, and it's not a sign of a problem. And like I say, if you feel like you need to go through and thin it out, you can certainly do that. But this is not a situation where that whole limb has to be taken off.
Well, all of the leaves are on the bottom of it, and then there's probably at least 10 foot where it's bare going up to the trunk. But so you prefer winter pruning. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, for my benefit as much as for the trees. The trees don't really care. I think there's less stress when you do it in the winter months, but nothing wrong with pruning. I had, and that's one thing about drought. It seems that trees become more brittle when we have extreme drought, and I had a live oak. It was a leaning tree that's probably 12 or 14 inches in diameter, and it just snapped off and came down, you know, across my driveway. So nothing wrong with pruning if you need to, but don't listen to the ones that say, you don't have to paint the wounds if you prune in the summer. I don't want to risk oak wilt. You don't have to use pruning paint. You can use the cheapest old latex paint you can find. I don't think I'd use bright orange, or your neighbors will wonder about you, but it's you only have to keep the wounds protected for about 8 to 10 days, and then it seals to the point that the oak wilt fungus can't get started. But it sounds like, you know, this is probably not a do-it-yourself job, and I will tell you, ask around, ask your friends, find a good arborist to do the work for you, and if you need to get it done, nothing wrong with doing it, but there's nothing wrong with doing it later in the year if that's more convenient for you.
Okay, well, we always paint, and we're out in the country, so our only neighbors are the squirrels. if I could discourage them, I'll paint everything orange.
Well, Squirrels for problem. I will tell you, and I have more problems with the black mantle rock squirrels than I do with the fox squirrels that are up in the trees. But a neighbor friend gave me this device called a squirrelinator, and that is the most amazing trap I've ever seen. People had told me about them, and I thought, oh, you must be exaggerating. But you can catch, you know, 4, 6, 8 squirrels at a time. It's a live trap. You can release them, or you can do as you want to with them. But if you really want to cut down on your squirrel population, look into getting a squirrelinator. It's a clever thing. You put your bait kind of in the center and just put the trap on top of it. Bird seed is what my friend used, and I've used corn and bird seed and other things. And those little guys just push their way in and can't get back out. And it's a lot of fun being able to catch several of them at one time. So if squirrels are a problem to you. Believe me, I don't have any stock in the company. I wish I did. But the squirrelinator has proven to me to be a very, very effective way of cutting down on the numbers of the squirrels.
I'll be darned. Well, you know, just quickly, we use those molasses buckets to store our bird seed in.
Right.
They actually eat a hole in that to get into the barrel.
I buy those smaller, you know, galvanized garbage cans to put in because, squirrels are just a rodent. They're just, I get teased and harassed sometimes by friends because I call them a bushy-tailed tree rat. But they are first cousin, and those incisors will do a lot of damage to a lot of things. My friend Howard Garrett up in Dallas, the dirt doctor, he was saying yesterday that he is seeing significant squirrel damage where the squirrels are chewing the bark off trees, in some cases even completely girdling. I guess they're trying to get water or maybe electrolytes. So they're not your friends.
Wow.
They may be cute.
No, they're not.
But
you're right.
they're good food. They're good food for Texas rat snakes. I'll put it that way.
All right. Well, thank you for your help.
It is always a pleasure, Gene. Thank you for the call this morning. I really appreciate it.
Goodbye.
All right. Let's go ahead and take one more call before we have to take a break, and that would be Omar. Good morning, Omar. How are you, sir?
Oh, Bob, how you doing?
Off to a good start. It's a pretty day out there.
It is. I'm looking after some calves right now for a neighbor. Yeah, it's night out for now.
I tell you, I don't know where they get the energy to run in this heat. I've got some calves that are, probably 2 or 3 months old now, and they just, I feel sorry. My business partner has just one calf right now, and it doesn't have any buddies to run around. But boy, if you've got a few of them, they are just so much entertainment. it's really fun. But anyway, what's going on in your world that I can help with?
I've got another asparagus question. I've got 3 different 1 gallon pots, and each of them have about 6 or 7 stalks in them, and they're 12 inches, you know, standing straight up, or 12 inches kind of laying over. But was wondering, should I put them in one of my molasses tubs, or leave them be for now, or let them overwinter in there? Or I found some extra seed that I didn't know I had.
Yeah.
And I was going to go ahead and put it in the 1 gallon pots and
right next to
the other ones, but
I'd move them up to your big containers as soon as possible. The bigger and deeper the root system they have, the better they'll get through the hot summer, the more production you'll get next spring. And a molasses tub with a few holes in the bottom is an ideal place to grow them because you don't have to bend over to pick them. But they're going to be happier in the bigger pot than they are. I wouldn't say that about every plant, but asparagus are one thing that if you don't have a place to put them in the ground, putting them in a really big pot like that would be a really good idea.
Okay, could they live their life in there? I was planning on that's where they were gonna stay.
Probably every 6-7 years you want to go dig and thin them out, but they can stay in there indefinitely. But eventually they will get so thick that you can have an asparagus sail on roots if you like. But you want to go thin them out a bit, but that's years down the road. I would consider that a permanent home for them.
Gotcha. And it's okay to put those 3 three potted plants, you know, just pull them out of each one and put them in one tub or in individual tubs?
I would very definitely put them all in the same tub, but
okay.
Your smaller pots, if you have more than one plant per pot, don't try to divide them. This is not the time of year you want to be separating them out, but just planting them. And you're not really transplanting, you're planting. And a lot of people confuse that because you're just taking them out of one pot and putting them into another pot. And you can do that 365 days a year. But actual transplanting, where you're separating them, where you may be doing damage to the root system, no, this would be a terrible time for transplanting most things. But as far as planting, it's 9:20 or actually 9:17, so I think you've waited a little late in the day because that sun's already hot. But the plants don't care. The sooner you get it done, the happier they'll be, and the easier it'll be to keep them properly watered.
Gotcha. Will do. Enjoyed it. Appreciate it.
Well, it's always my pleasure. You get out and enjoy those calves and don't get kicked. That's the only thing about it, Omar. But you have a great weekend. It's always a pleasure to hear from you.
Thank you.
We need to get a commercial break in here, Jimmy. Don't have any lives at this point, so let's run those. Got some open lines, too. Grab on them if you like, and we'll be right back here on KTSA.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to gardening. Looks like it's going to be Ann and Romero and Suzanne. Ann is first in line. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning. Well, about a month and a half ago, we did something really stupid. We needed some bunch of landscaping done, and so we had Celebration Bermuda laid out.
Okay.
Well, you know what has happened with 100-degree temperatures, and we're struggling. Some of it's doing okay. Some of it's not doing so hot. But should we be putting any kind of fertilizer down right now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And with organic products, you don't even have to rush to water them in. They don't really go to work until you do water them. But there's absolutely no negative. And your plants, especially new Bermuda that's trying to get some roots down, it really does need the nutrition. And there are a lot of good ones out there. Medina, of course, makes what they call Growing Green. Maestro Grow makes a really good one called Texas Tea. The Nature's Creation folks make one they call Premium Lawn and Garden Food. Those are all excellent fertilizers for your new Bermuda, and I would put them on just as soon as you possibly can. Like I say, it'll be good to water on your regular watering day, but these products do not burn. It's not like the synthetic stuff that somebody better be walking behind you with a hose. I wouldn't recommend those this time of the year, but I wouldn't recommend them any time of the year. But, no, if you're staying organic, then I can't think of anything other than water that would help that new Bermuda more.
Okay, good, because yesterday we went over to Brookstone and got a bunch of really good dirt, compost dirt, because where they laid the grass, it kind of, like, drops down. So we filled that in with dirt, and then we spread some Bermuda seed yesterday. So it wouldn't even hurt to probably put that in along with that seed also then?
Oh, no, it would be just fine to do. Now,
okay.
I will tell you, it's a tough time to try to get Bermuda seed germinated and growing. Almost need to get out there with a little fine sprayer on the end of your hose and try watering it down 4, 5, 6 times a day. Don't have to put down a lot of water right now, but you really need to keep that seed on the moist side to get it to sprout in this kind of drought and heat.
Okay. I just want to share something with you. We're talking about bucket gardens, and my husband plants rhubarb. And we've had rhubarb all year.
Wow.
In big buckets with like a shaded area. I know, nobody can believe it. In fact, we made a pie with the last of the cuttings about a couple weeks ago.
Wow. I was in Wisconsin a couple of weeks ago and saw wonderful rhubarb, but I don't know anyone in this area that really grows good rhubarb. My hat's off to you. You're a blue ribbon gardener if you can grow rhubarb.
No kidding. We're from Nebraska, so I've been known to bring it home in a suitcase back then. But he ordered rhubarb roots online, and he's fixing to dig the roots up and put them in some fresh dirt in his bucket. So I just thought I'd share with you because we've had
I appreciate that. Tell him not to be in a hurry to do it because transplanting from one spot to another in this kind of heat is pretty hard on the plants. If the plants are okay where they are, it'd probably be better to wait until September, October, when we get our first few little cool fronts coming through. The plants will transplant much better at that time. But I'm not going to tell you how to do it. If you're growing rhubarb, you're a better gardener than I am.
Well, that's about the only thing he's gotten that grows. Rhubarb's awesome. So.
Well, y'all enjoy.
All right. Have a good day.
You do the same, and thank you for the call, Ann. All right. Next in line is Romero. Good morning, Romero.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
I had a question regarding, I recently purchased approximately 4 acres in the San Antonio area. Thank you.
Congratulations. That's good. Yeah.
It's inside the city limits of San Antonio, but I noticed there's literally thousands of what I believe are elm trees planted on there, and they're anywhere from 8 to 15 feet in height.
Uh-huh.
But they're so closely together, and I'm wondering if do I need to remove some of them because they're encroaching on each other.
Well, elm trees, you know, they're not as bad as oaks about really growing close together and with a kind of a community root system and what we call a mott. When you've got them that close together, you will not see the beauty of individual trees. You know, they're going to kind of crowd each other. It's not going to hurt them to be close together. They will definitely use more water. But if it keeps you from enjoying your new property, nothing at all wrong with thinning them out. Now, you certainly can't transplant in this kind of heat. If you want to just simply thin them out by cutting a few of them out, you can certainly do that at this time of year. If you're hoping to transplant the smaller ones, you'll need to wait until probably November or December to do that. But first thing I would do is verify that they are indeed elm trees, because elm's a good tree to have. If it's a hackberry, man, I'd be cutting pretty freely on those things. But no, if you've got elm
trees,
they're
not hackberries.
Yeah. Well, you leave the ones that you like. You remove the ones that you don't. It's not going to hurt the trees to be close together, but if it interferes with your being able to use and enjoy your new property, nothing at all wrong with thinning them out, and the ones that you leave behind will appreciate having more water to go around. So what part of town is your new property in?
On the northwest, in the Ingram Park area.
Okay. Well, you got a good thing going. If you've got good elm trees already started on your property, you're going to have a lot to enjoy in years to come. That's fantastic.
They're very similar to the trees I see along the interstates and in the city streets. They're planted like in the middle.
Yeah.
So that's why I believe they're elm trees.
Yeah. Well, if you're in doubt, just, you know, take a little small limb off one of them and take it by a good nursery, or even take a good close-up picture and send it to somebody, and you can usually get an answer on that pretty quickly.
Okay.
I'm not a fan of, whether your property's a tenth of an acre or 10 acres, I'm not a fan of having a lot of the same type of tree. If I was going to have 100 trees on 4 acres, I'd have, 10 different kinds of trees and 10 each. So if you plant more, find some other good things to mix in there. But sounds like you got a pretty nice piece of property.
Yes. Let me ask you this. Is that something that the city of San Antonio planted? Because why would they be so close together and spread all over the property?
Well, you're going to find that answer out for yourself next year when you see how many seeds they produce. Elm trees, literally, we sometimes, and I have elms, my business partner has elms on her property, and there are times that you can't see the ground for all the seeds. When we have the right kind of weather, one elm tree may produce 10,000 or probably more than that seeds. And then if the weather's right for them to germinate and grow, in fact, I can tell you one of the principal things that I'm pulling out of flower beds and, vegetable beds right now are the hundreds of little elm seedlings that are coming up, because I have two pretty nice sized ones right outside my house. And, man, they throw their seeds everywhere, and I get bukus of them. They probably were planted by nature, not planted by the city.
Oh, okay. And another thing on the elm trees, I don't see him. I don't see the flare that you always mention on the base of the tree. There's no flare on them. It's just like stick.
On a young tree, it may have just not really started forming a flare yet. And it sounds like these are relatively young trees. I mean, by the time they start forming a flare, they may be more like 25 or 30 feet tall than like, you know, 8 or 10 feet tall. But you might just take a rake or something like that, or a little hoe or something, and just pick one and kind of pull the soil back. You'll see where the roots are starting to come out. But on young trees, it takes years to develop a flare. So I doubt that there's any problem there. I think they're just young trees, Romero.
Oh, okay. Can I ask you a question on wild sunflowers?
Of course.
I have also a lot of the wild sunflowers growing on my property, but most of them are dying out because of lack of water.
Right.
And they're not even flowering. So are those going to come back the following year, or are they just going to disappear?
No, almost certainly they're going to come back. At least a number of them will have, you know, formed seed heads, and one sunflower can make a couple of hundred seeds. So, and, you know, probably a lot of seed did not sprout this year. That's one thing about nature and one thing about dry years especially. Mother Nature has made those seeds fairly hard and tough, so that in a year when they're not likely to really thrive, there'll be plenty of seed left over to sprout next year or the year after, if we do indeed move back into a rainier period. So you're probably going to have plenty of them. Now, good luck in convincing the city that those are wildflowers and not something they're going to harass you about keeping them mowed down to 3 inches high. You tell them that's your wildflower garden and you like them, and you'll take them out when they become unattractive. But the birds love the sunflowers. They're good cover for many different things. And, we've got, even here at our nursery, we've got some spots where they're not in the way, so we just let them come up and bloom every year. But, no, they'll be back next year if we get rains and a little bit better growing conditions.
Well, I have certain areas that are just so concentrated I can't even walk through. So what's the best way to control them? Yeah.
Well, the best thing would
get rid of them.
The best thing would have been when they were younger to go through and just pull them out, you know, pull 10 and leave one. At this point, they're pretty much through with their productive season. So when they come back next year, they're going to come back from seed, not from the roots. So when they become unattractive, just either cut them down to ground level or pull them up.
Okay, very good. Well, I appreciate it, Bob. Thank you very much.
Well, congratulations on your new place, and you give me a call anytime you got questions. Always here for you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. Goodbye. All right, Suzanne, hang on just a minute. You are up next. Jimmy, let's get a break in here and get back to phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, let's get back to gardening. Once again, got some open lines. The nice thing is there seems to be a lighter commercial load. We're not having to listen to the same commercial over and over and over. And I love that. I hope that continues. But it also means we've got more time to talk to more folks. So if you've got a question, don't hesitate to call me, 210-599-5555. Suzanne is next in line. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning.
Good morning.
One question. A quick question about nutgrass. I have a beautiful asparagus bed. They're like 3 feet tall, but nutgrass has taken over, and I dug it out one time. It came back. How do you get rid of that stuff?
Well, it's nut sedge, as it's properly called, it's one of those things that's really, really hard. Generally speaking, especially when it's hot and dry like this, if you will treat it with molasses, I use liquid molasses and fairly concentrated, maybe half a cup of molasses to a gallon of water, and it doesn't have to be expensive molasses. It can be just, you know, good old feed-grade agricultural molasses. But about half a cup of molasses to a gallon of water, just pour that over the nut sedge. Do it again in about 2 weeks, and I have almost totally eliminated. Eventually, it just, you know, starts turning yellow and rotting away within a few weeks. Now, if it's an area that gets regular watering, it's an aquatic plant. It's just going to thrive. If it stays really wet, there's nothing short of a nuclear weapon that's going to kill it. But in a drier condition, molasses, I say jokingly, but in a drier condition, 2-3 applications of molasses will help your other plants, but the it's just too much of a good thing for the nut sedge. It just rots away.
Uh-huh. And it will not hurt the asparagus?
No.
We don't water it that much. I'm really surprised that the asparagus is doing so well. We really don't water it that often. Well, when we do a deep soak.
And that's the right way to do it. It's once, you know, well, you've looked, you know what asparagus roots look like. They put down quite a root system, and consequently they are much more drought tolerant than blackberries and, you know, typical vegetable plants. And so just try to keep it on the dry side. But that's about the best thing I can tell you. The other thing that I will tell you is that nutsedge doesn't hurt anything. I remember old Malcolm Beck once told me that the healthiest cornfield that he had ever seen, he said, and Malcolm saw a lot of corn and other things, but he said the healthiest crop of corn he'd ever seen, he walked out into the field and it was a sea of nutsedge. He said the ground was just solid nutsedge and the corn was prettier than it ever seen it. So it's not really hurting your asparagus. It's a nuisance and doesn't look real pretty, but don't feel like you have to go to the extremes of digging it out, because that's never going to work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Well, I'll just leave it. So one last thing about asparagus. When they get dry and at the end of the summer, I cut them back, right? I cut them. When do you cut the asparagus back?
I typically try to wait until they freeze down in the winter. The longer they have green foliage on them, the stronger the roots are, the longer you can harvest that delicious stuff next spring. But anything that's unattractive, once it's, you know, and they just turn yellow and turn brown eventually, you can feel free to cut those back. But try to keep it going up into the winter months. And if it doesn't freeze down, then I will cut it back around the 1st of January. But most years, and, you know, I'm 30 miles north of San Antonio, so I'm a little cooler. But most years, by January, it is frozen back. And at that point, you can cut it back and mulch at any time.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the information.
Well, you get out and enjoy your day, and don't overheat. That's the most important thing. Thanks, Suzanne. Okay. Next in line is Josie, and then it's going to be Mark and Reese. Good morning, Josie.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I've got a couple of questions. Oh, but first, there's one good thing about this weather. I have not seen a mosquito or a fruit fly in a month.
Oh, just knock on wood when you say that. I was lying out watching for meteors, you know, this past week with the Perseid shower, and there were actually a few out there, a couple of really spectacular ones, but I think I had one mosquito all evening, and I was having the same thoughts exactly, that if there's anything good about it, but I don't know about you, I'd take a few mosquitoes right now to get a good rain.
Yeah, no kidding. Let's see, I've got a question about trees and a question about grass.
Okay.
I would love to put in a lacy oak, but I think a lot of them died in the 21 freeze.
Not established ones. I probably got over 100 of them. I've got a sort of a long pasture that runs up behind my house that has good deep soils. And I probably got 100 Lacey's oaks. When you start up the side of the hill, as the soil gets thinner, the trees get smaller. But I've got them there probably 3 feet in diameter, and I didn't see the first sign of damage on Lacey's oak. Red oak's got some damage, but I was at about 8 degrees, and my Lacey's oak didn't have a problem at all. So I would not let that stop you from planting them unless you live somewhere north of Fredericksburg, in which case we might reconsider.
No, I'm in San Marcos, and I had an arborist tell me one time to plant it in full sun, but I think the ones that I've seen are usually almost an understory tree.
They will take full sun. A lot of them, may start out as understory trees, but and they don't get quite as big as, say, my pecans or, you know, probably even the red oaks, but they're, you know, a lot of mine are full sun all day long, and they are one of the they're one of the dominant trees, and they just have no problems at all. And
they're so beautiful. They're just so beautiful.
And you probably know that the term Lacy doesn't refer to foliage or anything else. They're named for an old German naturalist that's the first one to describe them. But Lacy's oak, if you have deep soil, and if you're in the San Marcos area, you almost certainly have deep soil. So I say go for it. Lacy's oak should be a great tree for you.
Oh, I love them. Okay. Well, and it would be nice to have a Mexican sycamore. I need some variety besides escarpment oaks and cedar elms. I don't know if I can get enough water to a sycamore.
Well,
and the soil here is rocky, but it's so much better than it was in West Austin. I think we've got anywhere from a foot to 3 feet before you get to bedrock. So I just don't know.
You know, look into your crystal ball and tell me what the weather's going to be for the next 20 years. Mexican sycamores, you know, up until, and we've been in bad drought for 2 years, but up until that point, we didn't have to give our Mexican sycamores any supplemental watering. Now, when you go for 2 or 3 months without rain, yes, your Mexican sycamore is going to need water. But not that much more than an oak or, you know, another good tree for you to look at would be escarpment cherry. Great tree, great native tree. And you mentioned elms, you already have. But I wouldn't plant a yard full of Mexican sycamores, but I certainly wouldn't be opposed to planting a couple of them. Another tree to look at is the one called Montezuma cypress. Now, people think of cypress trees as being river trees, and swamp cypress, you know, they certainly are trees that love moisture. Those are the big dominant trees we have here at our nursery that we planted 40 years ago. They're incredibly beautiful. But the Montezuma cypress, one good thing, it doesn't get the knees, and the other good thing is it's not a water hog by any means. They grow in the deserts of northern Mexico. In fact, there's a little one in the town of Tule, Mexico. I've not been there, but Howard Garrett was there a few years ago, and he photographed, they call it the Tree of Tule, and it's like, I don't know, 150 feet tall. The trunk is like 21 feet across. They corded and found that it was 2,600 years old. So a pretty durable tree, and like I say, this area where this tree is Chihuahuan Desert, I believe. So Montezuma cypress would be another excellent tree for you. Semi-evergreen, they're going to drop their leaves in a cold winter. They're going to hold some of them through a typical winter. So that'd be another good tree for you to take a look at. Not the bald cypress, but the Montezuma cypress.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Okay. The other question is about grass, because I'd like to put some seaweed on the lawn with a hose end sprayer. But I'm not going to be able to water it in.
No problem.
So would that just be a waste? I mean,
you know, liquid seaweed is one of those things that I think does better as a foliar spray. I mean, I use it in my vegetable garden. I use it on bedding plants. It kind of stains things a brown color sometimes, but that's not an issue. But I think it is better as a foliar application, and there's nothing in there that's going to burn. So other than having some little chocolate drops on the leaves of your grass, don't hesitate to put it out. It's, it's got so many different micronutrients in it. If you feel like you have any iron deficiencies or anything else, I've gotten where I'm much more fond of this dry product called Azomite, which can also be a good thing to add. But if you want to spray with liquid seaweed, go right ahead and spray.
Okay. Well, it's good for the trees, too.
It's good for everything.
I've got several patches of St. Augustine that are brown and crispy. I don't know. I mean, it wouldn't hurt anything, and it would help the trees. I just didn't want to waste it, you know.
Absolutely. And when it does cool off this fall, I'm going to be telling people, you know, that half inch of compost is going to be the most important thing you do for your grass. But if anybody's got a really beautiful green lawn right now, I can promise you they're not following the drought rules. That's the most common thing we see, and it's several people every day coming in with pictures of struggling grass this summer.
Well, I'd rather have a lake or an aquifer than St. Augustine, so it's okay with me, and it'll either come back or it won't. So
best attitude.
Yeah. Well, that's real helpful. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
It's always a pleasure. You get out and enjoy, Josie. Pleasure visiting with you. Let's see. We better get a break in here. Mark and Reese will be my next two callers, and we'll be right back.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right. My next two callers are Mark and Reese, and Mark is up first. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning. Off to a good start. It's a hot day, but right now it's just a beautiful day out there. So far be it for me to complain.
Yeah, I heard you talking about large oak trees yesterday and watering them. I have a oak tree, two of them that are about 11 feet in circumference.
Uh-huh.
And one of the trees has a limb that fell off. I was wondering, should I water them? How do I water them if I do need to water them? And besides the growing green, what other recommendations do you have to keep them healthy?
Well, and I will tell you the same comment I made to my partner the other day, because we both have not oaks, not as big as yours, but probably some with trees, some with trunks that are 3 feet thick. And these trees are probably 200 years old. They have been through droughts worse than what we're experiencing right now, and they came through without any problems. So at this point, I don't feel like those oaks are in any trouble, and it would be nice if you have the water to give them a little bit of supplemental water, but there are a lot of other things I'd worry about watering before I'd worry about that big oak. It's, like I say, it's been there, done that, you know, before. If you do want to supplement the water, keep it, you know, maybe 10 feet out from the trunk. You don't have to go out to the drip line, which is probably a long way out on that tree. So watering would be nice. Losing the limb, as you probably heard me say, I lost a whole tree. It was already leaning, but just snapped off. And when we get severe drought, we do have what they call it summer limb drop syndrome, where occasionally, more on elms and pecans than on oaks, but even on oaks, sometimes a limb will just come out, come crashing down for no apparent reason. I think it's because there's less moisture in the wood, and consequently the limbs are a little bit more brittle. So if you've got the water, it would be nice, but your tree's almost certainly going to survive this. Now, who knows how long this drought's going to last? None of us, you know, have that crystal ball. But I guess bottom line is that if you can water it, do so, but don't make it a high priority. There are lots of other shrubs and flowers and vegetables and things like that that are probably going to be in greater need of the water.
Okay. And the other thing, I was going to put out some mulch. I have access to cedar mulch or the darker mulch, even the living mulch. Do you have any recommendations, one over the other?
Well, living mulch just means they've had some good compost mixed in with the mulch, and that is always the best product. But you can take any mulch, be it cedar mulch, be it cypress mulch, be it mulch from the brush dump. You can add some compost yourself and turn it into an excellent mulch. And what I can tell you is the best mulch is free mulch. So whatever you have access to, I'd be looking at price before I was looking at anything else. Now, I am not a fan of the dyed mulches. I think the dyed black mulch and the dyed red mulch are just ugly to begin with. The dyes that they use are toxic materials that are not good for your pets. And I don't think it makes any difference. I do like, in general, I think a native mulch, a mulch that's made from materials that are already growing around your area, is going to be better than a pine needle mulch that comes out of East Texas or something comes out of Louisiana. But mulching is a great idea, but you get what you can get, and don't pay a fortune when you can get something for a lower price. And if you want to make it better, like I say, just add some good compost to it. Now, if you're looking for a good bagged living mulch, I think Nature's Creation is the best brand name that I have found, but it doesn't have to be expensive to be good.
Okay. And in the past, I was told that cedar mulch kind of deters the pests, the bugs are away. Is that true or not, or is it significant?
Well, that's a great question. And the answer is fresh cedar mulch, cedar that has, you know, some of the cedar oil in it, is repellent to both reptiles and quite a number of different insects, including mosquitoes. But if you are buying a cedar mulch, what you're probably getting is cedar that they've taken all the oil out of, because cedar oil is a very good commodity, and you know, and they can sell the distilled oil for a lot of money. So if you've got somebody, like I have a wood chipper, and we chip up our own cedar trees, and that's excellent mulch. But there are people who will tell you, oh, no, cedar trees have something in them that keeps plants from growing at all, and that's simply not true. You don't find things growing around cedars because they shade the ground too much, but there's no compound or chemical in there that's allelopathic, which means it hurts other things. So, you know, cedar mulch is good, and fresh cedar mulch most definitely will be repellent to insects. But if you're buying it in bags or if it's really old and aged, probably not going to get a lot of repellency in that.
All right, Bob. Well, I appreciate the information. You're always a wealth of information. Thank
well,
you.
I've made so many mistakes in the gardening world that if I could just keep you from making the same ones, I'll be doing a good thing. But just don't put any mulch right up against the trunk of your trees. Mulch needs to go out over the root zone. Just think about how Mother Nature does. It just rains those leaves down and, you know, covers up the root zones, but doesn't pile them up against the trunk. So you do the same, and your trees will love you for it.
All right. Thanks again, Bob.
My pleasure, Mark. Thank you. All right, Reese, we only have about a minute left here before news, and I don't want to have to rush you. So you're a very patient person. Just hang on through the news, and we'll make you first afterwards. Everybody else looking for a line, if you've been getting a busy signal, I do have three other open lines right now. So you know the number, 210-599-5555. Do remember, and I talked to somebody yesterday who was watering the yard as frequently as possible, but watering very lightly. If you have a sprinkler system and you're watering grass with it, you don't have to water very often. But you want to be sure that you water thoroughly when you do. 15 minutes, you might as well not be watering at all. That just wets the surface of the soil, does very little to help your plants, including your grass. If you want to know how long to water, instead of a straight-sided dish or something out in the pattern of your sprinkler system, turn it on and time how long it takes to run an inch to an inch and a half of water into that container. That's how long each zone of your sprinkler system needs to run if you're really going to do a thorough job of watering grass or ground cover or anything else. But again, if you're watering frequently and lightly, you're really not doing any good at all. Just remember, when you water, do a very thorough, good job of it. We'll be right back. We've got another hour of gardening here on KTSA Radio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening. Now you know there's not really much good news going on in the world. We get back to gardening where it is always, always upbeat and positive. And y'all are just the greatest listeners in the world. Ask such good questions. Makes such a pleasure to be here on Saturday and Sunday mornings. We're going to talk to Reese, and then it's going to be Angel and Mike and E.T. Good morning, Reese.
Good
Hi,
Reese.
Good morning.
Yeah, how are you doing? Can you hear me properly, Bob?
I can hear you loud and clear.
Okay, thank you. Because I'm on the iPhone, that's why I was wondering.
Well, you're good, or my English teacher would want me to say I hear you loudly and clearly, but I have no problem understanding you. How can I help today?
Okay, I know you discourage transplanting any plant in the landscape, big or small, at this time of the year. But how about moving a small plant, you know, from one container to the other? I have a bougainvillea, and it's in full bloom, and I don't want to kill it.
Well, you're not going to kill it. And, well, just one other thing. Plants that I do recommend transplanting are cycads and palm trees. This is the time of year we do that. But what you're talking about is not really transplanting. You're just moving from one pot to another. You're not disturbing the root systems, and you do that 365 days a year. If that bougainvillea needs a bigger pot, that's fine. Now, I will tell you that bougainvilleas bloom best when they are root-bound. So don't be in a hurry to move it. I like to say the only two times you really, really need to transplant is when the plant has gotten so big that you can't keep the pot standing up, or when it's hard to keep it watered, because the more root-bound it becomes, the faster it uses the water. But a root-bound plant in general is a much happier plant than a small plant in a big pot, and bougainvilleas in particular really like being a little bit crowded in order to get those spectacular blooms. But having said that, if your plant needs a bigger pot, you're just slipping it out of one pot, putting it in the other, don't hesitate to do that. It's not going to harm it one bit to do that at this time of year.
Oh, great. That's great to hear that. And another question is, we make our own mulch, you know, from the clippings we get from lawn mulch.
You're a great gardener. Yeah.
Yeah. Is it good to add compost to it, Bob?
It makes, you know, when you think about nature, which is our greatest teacher, Mother Nature takes mulch and gradually turns it into compost. So when you add some compost to it, it just takes a good thing and makes it even better. It turns it from a mulch to what we call a living mulch. Adding the compost puts a great deal more microbial life in there. Mulch is good. Living mulch is even better. So if it's convenient for you to add some compost to it, that's a great thing. But it doesn't mean it's not good just used in and of itself. So you do what's convenient and available to you.
All right. Thank you so much for all the questions and answers, Bob. Have a good day. That's all I have for today.
Well, Reese, you get out and enjoy, and we will talk again. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Certainly. Goodbye. All right. I never know whether to say Angel or Angel. Angel, anyway, welcome to the Garden Show. How can I help you?
Well, Bob, that's okay. I answer to either way. my questions are, I've got four hickory trees. I live out here in the Natalia area where it's primarily sand, and there's a lot of native hickory trees around here.
Right.
However, I've got four of them that have no leaves on the top. And these are pretty well established trees. And I'm wondering, am I going to lose these trees, or
is there
anything I could do for them?
Supplemental water is probably the best thing you can do. As you know, you don't see a lot of hickory trees here because they don't especially like our soils, and they certainly don't like our droughts. But if yours have grown to be big trees, obviously your little microclimate is good for these trees. But this drought is really serious. I mean, I saw something, actually a friend sent me, because I don't do social media, but they sent a picture of someone who took a carpenter's tape and stuck it down in a crack in the ground in their yard, and that crack went down 16 feet. You watch them pull the measuring tape up. So this drought is really severe, and your hickories are suffering as a result of it. If you can mulch them, if you can give them supplemental water, that will help them get through it. Now, who knows how long it's going to last. It could turn around next week and give us good rains, or the drought could go on for years. And without some help, these hickory trees could also suffer some serious damage. Now, one thing that the dirt doctor, Howard Garrett, was saying that they're seeing up in the Dallas area is squirrels have actually been chewing the bark off of trees. And nobody knows whether it's for moisture, whether it's some micronutrient they're going after. But Howard was telling me that he's seen a number of trees where the squirrels have completely girdled the bark all the way around the tree. And as a result, the tree above that point has died out. And he said he's seen lots of healthy trees with dead tops. So if you've got lots of squirrels out there, that may be something of an issue. My feeling, it probably is mainly drought. The trees are probably going to survive it. But if you have the capacity to add some mulch over the root zone, if you have the capacity to give them a good thorough soaking, both of those things will certainly help them.
Okay. I also have some compost manure that I had purchased, and I have it piled up right now and trying to figure out where am I going to put it. So I take it, putting some around them would help them.
It would very definitely help them. If it's good, clean manure, that's ideal. If you had, you know, some brush trimmings or anything like that, you could mix with it to make it go further. There's just no such thing in this kind of weather as too much mulch, too much compost. You don't want to pile it up around the trunks, but out over the root zone, every shrub, every tree, even xeric plants that tend to grow even in deserts, even those guys would love some mulch and a little bit of supplemental water. We've had like one or two good rains in the past couple of years, so things are, the subsoil is really, really dry.
Okay. And I also know that I've heard before many times you talking about this, because I have two small oak trees that I had planted.
Right.
And these little oak trees, they got brown leaves on them right now, and they're not falling off, and they've been like that for about a month.
Do they have any green leaves along with the brown leaves?
Yes.
Yes. Well, I'm not really concerned about them. Then they probably will come out of it. Would just, anytime you're out in the yard around those trees, pick up the hose, put your thumb over the end of it, and just spray up and down the bark of the trees. I've got you know, many, many oak trees, many of them absolutely enormous, and I'm starting to see little branch tips of just a tip of dead leaves here or there. My friend David Bond, that's the best arborist I know, he comes up regularly to fish, but he was telling me that that's perfectly normal. If you're looking up at your oak tree and you've got clumps of dead leaves, that's drought related and probably not a threat to the overall health of the tree. If these are young trees, you can do an awful lot to help them with both watering and just, you know, spraying water over the trunk and leaves and things like that. But these trees aren't on their way out. This is their response to drought. Not to say that they couldn't die if things don't get better, but these are trees that you can really benefit with some supplemental moisture.
Okay, yeah, I've heard you say that many times, and that's one of the things I'm always doing is when I'm watering, I'm spraying it completely down.
Well,
and then also one last thing is, I'm guessing it's probably going to be drought related as well, and that's these crepe myrtles.
Yeah.
A couple of my crepe myrtles, I noticed the tips of their leaves are brown. I'm guessing that's drought related as well.
That's root damage. When you see the tips root turning damage. Brown, you know that something is damaging their roots. This year, it is almost certainly drought related. It can be, though, we sometimes see that caused by herbicide damage, which is not something you're doing. We see it sometimes as a result of the trees being buried too deeply, having soil piled up above the root flare. There are lots of things that can cause brown leaf tips, but brown leaf tips are a sign of some root damage, and drought is the principal cause of that root damage right now.
Okay. All right. Very good. Oh, one last thing. And that is, I know you have a show that comes on and starts on Saturdays, but I can never remember exactly what time. And the same thing goes for your Sunday show. What time do you start?
On Saturdays, it's too damn early. I'll tell you that for sure. But gardeners get up early, and it flatters the heck out of me. The show starts at 5:30 in the morning. And frequently, by the time I go on the air, there are already four people on the phone lines waiting to talk. So that flatters the heck out of me. But Saturdays are 5:30 till 9. Sundays are 8 till 11. And then Dr. Kirby comes in, and I have the great pleasure of sitting in with him and learning a little more veterinary medicine from 11 to 12. But anyway, Saturday's show starts at 5:30. Sunday show starts at 8.
Very good. And I'm always up at that time anyway. I'm a mail carrier.
I'm
always out on the road already by then, getting into the station to get stuff
Neither
ready.
The rain nor snow nor dark of night, and you're used to the dark of night. I'm a morning person, but I tell you, I'd rather sleep till 5 or 5:30 than 3:15, which is when my alarm goes off on Saturdays. But it's fun, and again, feel like I get to talk to the nicest people about this across this part of the country. So you're one of them, and you get out and have a good weekend.
Hey, likewise. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, sir. Goodbye. All right, need to get a break in here, and then it'll be Mike and E.T. and Ruth. We'll be right back here on KTSA.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Going to be Mike and E.T. and Ruth. Mike's first. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Bob. It's a beautiful morning.
It is that.
But the birds are keeping me shuffling back and forth to the grocery store to keep us supplied in sugar.
Amen to that one.
Bob, I have a report to make to you and then a question.
Okay.
The report is on my dragon fruit I was telling you about a while back.
Yeah.
What I call the mother pot had about 36 plants coming up.
Uh-huh.
And they're doing real good, and I transplanted some in 3 other pots. They're doing okay, but not as good as the original mother pot. They're 4 or 5 inches tall in it and maybe 3 to 3.5 inches in the other pots.
Fertilize regularly and water. Dragon fruit is, in effect, a tropical cactus, but it's not a desert cactus. It wants good soil. It wants plenty of moisture. It wants plenty of nutrition. And they take a while to get their roots established. And I think you're just looking at young plants. But I would be, every 2 to 4 weeks, I'd be hitting them with something like Has to Grow Plant or the new Medina Liquid Fish formulation. And on things like that, I like to alternate. I use one time and the other the next time. But they're not known for fast growth. So as long as they're healthy, I would not be concerned. Now, don't keep the soil so wet that it's driving all the oxygen out of the soil. But they are a tropical cactus, not a desert cactus, and they do want very regular moisture.
Okay. I've been doing that. It has good drainage, mm-hmm. and I didn't know if I could separate some more of these out of the mother pot into some more pots.
It's up to you. It's going to set them back when you do that, but you're just going to have to be patient with them. They don't mind being crowded together, as long as there's room for the tops to spread out. But that's strictly up to you. I would wait until cooler weather before I started doing anything that would cause root damage to them. But where you've got new little plants or where you've had seeds sprout and come up, you certainly can move them on into their own pots. Now, any of them that are grown from seed, recognize that they will go through a maturing process that may take several years before they're mature enough to put on fruit. But anything that is growing as a start off of the big plant or anything that you have started as cuttings, those are coming into the world already mature, and they can have fruit as soon as they're big enough.
No, these are came in with seed is how I
yeah.
planted them. And they're
yeah.
a lot of fun. But it uh-huh. doesn't hurt to leave them bunched up together in what I call the mother plant, the mother pot.
It's not going to bother the roots of the plant. Just remember that the tops of the plants need to get good sunlight. And if they're so crowded together, they're shading each other out, then that's going to limit their growth. But if they're all grown up to the point that they've got plenty of what passes for leaves, if they have plenty of green tissue up in the sun, no, it's not going to hurt them a bit to be crowded together.
Okay, that's what I wanted to hear. Yeah, that's my report, but I have a question about daylilies.
Uh-huh.
They have some in pots, and they've all died back. My question is, will they come back next fall, next spring?
They should. I would, again, don't keep the pots so moist that, that the water's driving the oxygen out of the soil. They need to have moisture, even if they don't have much in the way of green on the top. And you can either keep them in pots or you can plant them in the ground. But if you acquire more daylilies, there are basically 3 different types of daylilies. And I had the pleasure a couple of weeks ago, as you probably know, of making the first time I've ever been in Wisconsin. We went up there and enjoyed a few days and saw some interesting botanical things up that way. And they have some of the prettiest daylilies you've ever seen. But they are a type of daylily that needs the cold, that goes totally dormant and then comes back the next spring. And that type of daylily does not do well here in South Texas. We have the second type, the most commonly grown ones, are what we call evergreen. They really don't have a resting period. They only freeze back if we have a really cold winter. And then there's some that are sort of halfway in between that we call semi-evergreen. So if your daylilies are of the variety that are the evergreens or the semi-evergreens, then they're probably going to be a good long-term plant for you. If there's some that came from a friend or came in mail order or for whatever reason, they are the type that normally go dormant, those daylilies are going to really hate a summer like this, and they're just not going to be happy long-term in Texas. So if you're buying daylilies, always get the evergreen varieties or the semi-evergreens because they're the ones that are going to do best in our area.
How do you tell an evergreen from a different type?
You research the variety of it, and you deal with somebody that you trust to have plants that are good for this area, and that's not HEB or Home Depot. They're going to bring in whatever they can find they think you will buy. And I have to say, a lot of the daylilies, they grow up in that part of the country. It's kind of like hostas. It's kind of like some of the echinaceas. Golly, the colors were intense up there. But you're just sentencing that poor plant to death to bring it down here to our hot weather and bad soil.
Right. But once again, the dragon fruit is a tropical desert type.
Well, no, it's right. It's a tropical non-desert type. It's
non-desert.
Yeah, it is a terrestrial, we would call it a terrestrial tropical cactus. It's related to Christmas cacti and things like that. And it does not ever want to become bone dry. If you treat it like a desert plant, it's not going to do well for you. And it's sort of a jungle cactus, you might say.
Okay. And as far as my red hot poker, they're kind of droopy, but I made a bunch of ladders around it to hold the leaves up. You said not to cut them off.
Right.
So and I better get going back to the store. Got to get some more sugar.
And get cane sugar if you can. Cane sugar is so much better than beet sugar. And just it should be somewhere on the package. And do remember, yeah, your red hot poker, your tritomas, they really like it a little bit cooler than it is. They're great plants, and they're absolutely unusual when they flower. But everything, including the gardeners, is going to be happy when it cools off a little bit. So go get your sugar and keep those hummers happy.
Thank you, Bob. You have a good day.
You do the same, Mike. Thank you for the call this morning. Let's go ahead and talk to E.T. is up next. Good morning, E.T.
Morning, Bob. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Well, I'm still kicking, so.
That's good.
I got a question about picloram. I mentioned a while back, our old barn, I picked up like a bucket full of cow droppings.
Yeah.
And I incorporated it to my couple of large nursery containers, and nothing seems whatsoever to grow. Is there a shelf life, or how can I get rid of it?
Picloram, there's nothing in nature breaks down this group of herbicides, sulfonated urea herbicides. And the only thing, as the environmentalist will tell you, the only answer to pollution is dilution. It doesn't break down. It's going to be causing problems, as long as, as you have it. If you have it mixed in with the soil, eventually it gets diluted. Eventually it's not as much of a problem as it is. But the best thing you can do with it is take it and dump it out on grass somewhere, because picloram doesn't hurt grass. That's why so many ranchers or so many hay producers use it, is because it kills everything else, but it doesn't kill the grass. Unfortunately, though, it's so persistent, it passes right through the cow or horse and stays in the manure. And if you put that manure on something other than grass, then it ends up killing it. So, it never goes away, but it can be diluted down over time. But if you've got picloram contaminated manure, best thing you can do is just put it on a grassy area, because not going to hurt the grass. Don't put it over tree roots, because it will ultimately kill trees too. But it's something that should be banned from the earth.
Okay, thank you. And tomatoes, I believe the romaine, I'm not sure if they're determinate or indeterminate, and if I take some cuttings and put them in fresh dirt, will they grow?
You would be best to root cuttings in perlite. Very few things this time of year, especially, can you just stick in dirt and expect them to take roots and grow. But Roma tomatoes, it just depends on the variety. They're both determinate and indeterminate varieties of those. But if you take your cuttings, root them in a pot of perlite, you can put like 10 different cuttings in 1 2-gallon container. But root them in perlite and then transfer them to soil, and they should do just fine.
Okay, great. And our last gentleman mentioned something about lilies. Are lilies detrimental to cats?
True lilies, bulb lilies, like Easter lilies and things like that, are very toxic. Yes, I would not have them around my kitties at all. The so-called daylilies are not nearly so toxic, probably still not a real good thing to eat. But true lilies, like the Asiatic lilies, Easter lilies, things like that, those are among the most toxic plants around. So the gentleman just before was talking about daylilies that aren't nearly as toxic. But true lilies, yes, they are very toxic.
Okay. And one more thing. It's been so hot lately that I put some suet in the suet feeder, and it all melted the next day.
Oh, and that's the issue. Homemade suet is just not going to work. Some of the, you know, Wild Birds Unlimited and places like that, they have a cake that is part suet that will stand up, you know, in the heat. And I love the stuff that the company called Mr. Bird is making that is treated with the super hot pepper. And it does stand up in the heat, and the raccoons and the squirrels can't eat it because it has so much pepper in it. But birds don't taste pepper heat. They don't have those heat receptors in their beaks. So the birds eat it like mad, but you'll never see a squirrel or a raccoon go after it. So if you're looking for a great cake type thing, look for what is called a flaming hot. They make some real good cakes that you can put in your suet feeders that will stand up, and we certainly don't have to worry too much about rain dissolving them either. But birds love them, and it's amazing the variety of birds you'll have going to them.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you very much, and you have a really pleasant rest of the day.
You do the same, E.T. Always good to hear your voice. Okay, Jeremy, guess we better get a break in here. We start with Ruth when we come back.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening. It's going to be Ruth and Terry are my next two callers, and Ruth is up first. Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have a question about amaryllis.
Okay.
When is the best time to separate them?
The best time is while they are dormant. This time of year, we're getting real close to the time that we normally start withholding the water, that we want the leaves to go ahead and die back all the way to the top of the bulb, because that's what stimulates or that's what starts the new flower buds for next spring. But that time, after the foliage dies, that's your very best time to separate them.
Okay. This year, for some reason, I have thousands of doodle bugs all over my yard. I've lived here 37 years. This is the first time. What is the deal?
They bother some of your plants. This was just apparently the perfect year for doodle bug or sow bug or whatever you want to call them, reproduction. And anywhere that you have been able to maintain adequate moisture, there are still, and I'm like you, there have been more of them around this year than I remember in recent years. Out in the country where it's gotten really dry, we're not seeing nearly as many as we did in the spring, but the conditions were just right for them to reproduce, and they took advantage of it, and there are lots and lots and lots of them. Now, they do eat tender vegetation. They love to eat on things like begonias, so they're not your friend. If you have large numbers of them, if you have bedding plants, you may want to put out something the Sluggo. Sluggo Plus is what we normally use for the pill bugs, and it will knock their numbers down. It's very safe, the plus. Sluggo is an iron sulfate bait, which is totally safe. It gets mainly snails and slugs. The Sluggo Plus, they add spinosad, which gets the pill bugs as well. So it's a good way to get them under control if you have too many. The other thing you can do is, in effect, make a pill bug trap where you take a glass jar of some sort, bury it down into the ground right up to the rim, and then put a little slice of apple or something like that in the bottom, and the pill bugs crawl in by the hundreds and can't get back out. So if you're seeing any pill bug damage, and like I say, begonias seem to be the thing they are really, really hard on, you might want to limit their numbers. But the reason we're seeing so many is strictly weather-related.
Well, maybe I'm calling them something different. They're the ones that make the little hole, and when an ant gets in there, they can't get out.
Oh, okay. Yeah, though some people call them doodle bugs. And
we always called them when we were kids.
Yeah, and the name I grew up knowing them by was they called them ant lions because that's what they do. They eat ants, and I'm with you. I have never seen so many of them. Those little, it's like kind of a little inverted cone down into the soil, and it's like a field of them. Just everyone touches the next one, and it's. Well, it's partly because it's so dry. It's so easy for them to make their little traps. And the ants still seem to be going strong. But, no, I love those guys. And every fire ant they get and get after is one less that we have to deal with. But, no, those call them ant lions, call them doodle bugs. I'm like you. I've never seen as many of them. But I think it's probably because the soil is just so dry. They're so easy for them to make their little traps.
Yeah, and I'm in sand country close to Lavernia, so so they really do.
And
it really is easy.
You're probably of that age that as kids we actually dug them up. Anybody who has kids or grandkids, it's interesting. They to me they look kind of like a hermit crab. They've got that one big claw.
Exactly.
We used to take and shake an ant down into the hole just to watch them come to life and grab that ant and start throwing sand and everything everywhere. But no, again, the weather is just right for them to make their traps, and I think that's why we have so many of them. But they are not harmful in any way, form, or fashion. And if they're taking out fire ants, they're my friends.
That's right. I have another question. What is garlic pepper tea used for?
Garlic pepper tea has two main purposes. Anything that has garlic in it, it's a natural fungicide. Garlic does a lot to actually prevent fungus and does a little bit to cure fungus problems where we see them. But the main thing is the pepper in there discourages deer, discourages raccoons, discourages things like that from eating our plants. And the original garlic pepper tea was a product that Gary DeMasters made for Maestro Grow. As a matter of fact, I talked just this past week to the folks that own Maestro now, and they say that the state, in its infinite wisdom, when that's, of course, very much an oxymoron, but they are requiring them, they're making them do so many tests and so many things that it's simply too expensive for them to produce. The state's just putting them out of business, requiring ridiculous testing to prove that it's a safe product. But you can certainly make your own if you have it. It's a great product, and it's one of the most effective deer repellents I've ever seen. But that's the main thing that garlic pepper is used for.
Well, how long would it last? I've had half a bottle of it for years.
Yeah, I would say it should probably last 10 or 20 years. There's nothing in there that's really going to decompose or break down. I will tell you, if you use it, of course, wash your hands well. And don't if you get it on your hands, don't get your hands near your eyes until you've washed them well. But, it has a very long shelf life. And as an animal repellent or deterrent, it's still a very, very good product. I was trying to talk him into going back into producing it again, and he said, well, if you can tell the state to get off our back and stop requiring so much idiotic testing, then maybe we'll see it back on the market. But that's why you're not seeing it on the nursery shelves right now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the tag on there does say Maestro Grow. So
yeah.
I've had it a long time.
Yeah, and Maestro Grow is a great company. I'm sorry, on amaryllis?
Do I just dig them up, the bulb, and just break them apart, or just
You're going to find that when the plant becomes dormant, that they separate very easily. The little smaller bulbs would just break off of the bigger ones. I would try to leave little tiny bulbs, anything that's, you know, the size of a marble, go ahead and leave it attached to the big bulb. But once they get as big as a ping pong ball, you can take them off and pot them up separately.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Thank you for all your information. I'll have to tell my sister who lives in Kerrville with all the deer and everything. Maybe she'd want to borrow some of this.
I think it would be a very good thing to do with it. And anyway, Ruth, you have a great weekend. I appreciate the call this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, certainly. Thank you. You have a good weekend, too. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. All right, let's go ahead and talk to Terry. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question. I have a question on the peach tree.
Uh-huh.
When would be a good time to prune, to cut it back?
We normally do that after the leaves come off in the fall. November, December, into January, that's the best time. Now, you don't really want to cut your peach tree back overall. You want to sort of thin it out a bit. But I tell you, I usually do mine in that December to January time frame. Easier to see what you're doing after they've dropped their leaves for the winter, and getting out and working when the weather's a little cooler is a real pleasure. But wouldn't be doing it at this time of year. Those trees need every leaf they've got to make what they need to stay alive through the heat. But once they've dropped their leaves in the fall, that'll be a time you can do your thinning.
And I can make it shorter. I can because otherwise it would be hard to reach the peaches. Or can I get the tops off?
You can. Yeah, you can. And really, when you plant young peach trees, that first year we cut them way back because we want them to really branch out from the base. And then, you know, you ought to be able to pick most of your peaches without getting up off the ground. So the first year we tend to prune them very heavily. After that, we go through and do more thinning out. But, yeah, take out the tall limbs that you can't get to and leave the lower limbs, and you'll have more fruit that way, and the fruit will be much easier to pick.
And this year I had lots and lots of small peaches, and I thought, oh, my gosh, it's going to be great. And then I went back a couple of days later. I was getting ready to harvest them. And I had about 12 left. I don't know what happened to them.
It's called possums, raccoons, and squirrels. And they somehow know when they get ripe. And they have, as I like to say, they invented the Internet a long time before Al Gore claims he did. And they have some sort of network they send out, and they call in all their friends and family from the surrounding counties. And I've seen them take a tree that had, you know, 200 peaches on it and not even leave a single one. You look on the ground underneath, and they're just peach pits everywhere you look. So, I'd have that live trap out, and I would send those guys to live somewhere else. If your trees are, you know, if they have a bare trunk for the first 3 or 4 feet, you can put a what they call a squirrel guard up that they can't get around. But most trees branch very low, and I tell you, they always take the best and the finest of the crop, and they're not. If they would just share, that would be one thing, but they want it all. So sometime around the 1st of September, 1st of October at the latest, I'd start trapping and removing those problem causers. Mm-hmm.
I was getting ready to, I was getting my jars out, getting ready to make some jelly and everything else, and nothing. And it was but anyway, okay, I do thank you so much for your help and your knowledge. Okay?
It's always a pleasure. I appreciate the call, and you have a wonderful Sunday, Terry. Thank you.
You too. All right. Thank you. God bless. Bye-bye.
You as well. All right, Christy, hang on a second. You will be up next. We're going to get our last commercial break of the show out of the way. Have time for 2 or 3 phone calls in the last little segment. Then it'll be time for Dr. Kirby.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to the phone line. Jimmy, probably have time, let's see here, for... oh, maybe 3 phone calls. So that is a couple beyond Christy. Good morning, Christy.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have a 2-part question.
Okay.
What do you recommend the best way for deep watering, like small trees and large bushes? And what do you think of those watering spikes that hook to your hose? Is that a good thing to do?
To me, those so-called deep waterers put too much water, but in a very limited area. And, you know, a lot of them actually go down below the level of that most of the roots are. Most of tree or shrub's roots are not 18, 24 inches down in the ground. They're much shallower than that. So I like watering on the surface. Now, things that I do not like soaker hoses, because soaker hoses let out about 90% of the water in the first 10% of the hose. So with the soaker hose, you've got one end that's really wet, the other end that is really dry. I do like what they call pressure-compensated drip tubing. There are many forms of drip irrigation. The ones that put out these little bitty spaghetti tubes and things, those tend to clog in our hard water. But this Rainbird product that they call pressure-compensated drip, it has a little emitter. Every foot puts out 9/10 of a gallon per hour, and it puts all the water in the ground. You lose almost nothing to evaporation. So for an automatic system, that is what I use. Vegetable garden, flower beds, it's just the most effective and most water economical way that I've ever found to do it. Now, places where you can't put down a tube, and this is a little tube that's about 1/2 inch, 5/8 of an inch in diameter, but obviously you can't put that out where you're going to run over it with a lawnmower or things. For my trees that I need to supplemental water, I just use I don't even know what they call it. I think they call it a bubbler. It's like sort of an oversized, looks like an expanded golf ball, so to speak. Put it on the end of the hose, and it dribbles the water out, doesn't spray it out. And I just put that on the end of the hose, lay the hose at the base of the tree, and let it run for, well, as long as it takes to water thoroughly. In most cases, it's a couple of hours. But the pressure-compensated drip is great in a vegetable garden, great in a flower bed. Having used it for several years, a few of the things that I have learned, the connectors, the things, the little L's, the little T's, things like that, those tend to get brittle in the sunlight. So I'll many times put a little bit of mulch or compost over the little connectors like that. But the tubing itself, I've had tubing for 5 or 6 years. It's still as good as the day I put it in.
Okay. All right. That sounds good.
And if you're ever by this, well, I was going to say we've got some little diagrams that will show you how I do it. The one thing that we did not put on there, but I would always, you need a way to flush it out. You need a way to clean it out. And the way that you typically do this is do a little pigtail, about a 6-inch piece of tubing that comes out one or more places along your system. You close it off. You just bend it over, and that keeps anything from coming out. They make a little sort of a figure eight thing that you can put on to do that. But depending on how much material you have in your water, maybe once a month, maybe once every 6 months, I will open it up, turn it on, and just let the pressure blow anything that's collected in the tubing out, shut it off again, and then I'm good for several more months. I live on a well, and there's lots of stuff in my water, so I probably do it a little bit more often than somebody living on city water has to.
Okay, very good. All right, thank you so much.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for the call this morning. And it's going to be Faye next, and then it's going to be Maria, and that'll probably finish up the show. Good morning, Faye.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I let something get a little too dry, and it's more than a little too dry, but I have some rosemary that we've had for years and a very pleasant rosemary I'm not wanting to lose. I've got some life left in the big bush, but what can I do to revive it?
Well, I will tell you that product called Super Thrive, as hokey as the packaging is on it. That's the thing that it's brought back plants that I thought were dead. Now, no guarantee. I can't see how far along yours are. And rosemary plants kind of turn into wimps as they age. And You're doing amazingly well if you get them to live for more than 10 or 12 years under any conditions. But your best bet of having it come back out and recover will be to put a little Super Thrive, and just a very small amount, like a capful of it in a watering can. Do that about every week or 10 days for 4 or 5 treatments, and if anything will bring it back, that will.
Okay, I'll do that. And then just generally, I'll get another plant if I have to, but watering it, what kind of schedule would you put on
this? In a pot or in the ground?
Pot, a large pot.
I'm going to water whenever the soil is dry on the surface. Rosemary does not like to get bone dry, and if it's a big plant, it's transpiring a lot of moisture, so it's not going to need to water quite as often if part of it has died back, but just stick your finger down in the soil. If that soil's dry half an inch deep, it's time to give that rosemary a thorough watering. How often that is will depend on how sunny it is and how windy it is.
Oh, okay. Well, I want to take care of rosemary because it's such an important part to the diet, I think.
I couldn't agree more. It's delicious. It's aromatic. There are a lot of good things to be said about rosemary, but it is not very forgiving if you let it get too dry.
Well, I'm going to go give it a shot, and I'll report back to you. And thank you, Bob. Look,
it's my pleasure always, Faye. Thank you. And goodbye. All right, probably finish the show up with Maria. Good morning, Maria.
Yes, good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Yes, I have two questions regarding air layering. My neighbor has a bougainvillea, and I'm not too sure if I can air layer it now. I need to wait till spring. Sorry.
I would say you can do it either time. It's a little harder in the summer months to keep that sphagnum moss moist. And you may have to open it up and re-moisten. It'll take 4 to 6 weeks usually for things to root with an air layer. And if you're doing it when the weather's a little cooler, then the sphagnum moss doesn't tend to dry out as quickly. But I tend to use aluminum foil rather than plastic wrap because I can really wrap it around and crimp the ends. And I'm comfortable with needles. I mean, I'm an old biologist by training and, you know, spend a lot of time in labs. And so I'll sometimes just take a big syringe, penicillin, whatever gauge needle that is, and just kind of stick it in there and re-moisten that sphagnum. But now is an ideal time to do it if you can keep your sphagnum moss moist.
Okay. So what about a Castorville, Texas fig tree, bringing, you know, air layering it and bringing it to San Antonio? Would it take?
Woody trees don't lend themselves very well. I'll never say never, but they're tropical plants take to air layers much, much more quickly. Anything in the ficus family, including figs, including houseplants like, rubber plants, fiddly figs, things like that, woody things like Schefflera's, tropical plants like hibiscus and geotropas, all of those, the air layers are almost 100% successful. But when you get into woody trees, the percentage of success rate is much, much lower. Mm. And it takes those plants a long time. When you look at, an oak tree, and that root starts out and it puts down what is sort of like a tap root, and that makes it a really strong, even when it's a tiny little plant, it has a really strong root system. When you're doing air layers, those are all what I would call lateral roots. The roots come out to the side. They're not, at least at first, they're not as firmly attached to the piece that you're air layering. Same thing's true of citrus. You can air layer citrus very successfully. But the first couple of years, you're probably going to have to give them support, try to keep them from rocking around so that you don't break those roots. Ultimately, they make a plant as good as a plant that it came off of. But once you get beyond the houseplants, they're not as successful.
Okay, fair. Thank you. And one last question. What's the chance of my sweet potato vines lasting over the winter, or do I need to replant new ones next year?
If you want to take some cuttings from it and keep them inside for the winter, that gives you, keeps you from having to buy more. Sweet potato vine actually is – closely related to the edible sweet potatoes, and many times they actually make a little underground tuber, just like the sweet potato we eat.
Okay.
And a lot of times, if the soil doesn't freeze hard, they will come back on their own. A lot of people are surprised when they just suddenly show up in the same area. But if it's an established bed, it's probably making a lot of little tubers underneath, and it will come back on its own.